guardian.co.uk.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
There was a terrible phase where I think you're trying to make sense of why everything's so wrong. And for some reason, I decided there was something actually physically wrong in my head, and that I had a piece of metal lodged in my head at one stage.
Social anxiety disorder is the fear of being rejected by other people, the fear of negative evaluation. You can tell if you have this disorder because you are likely to avoid social situations. You're likely not to speak up, not to get your ideas heard, and that's probably limiting you, holding you back from having friends, meeting new people, and being successful at work.
She didn't recognize his wife. She just kept forgetting which room she was in the house. All through the visit, she sort of kept her daughter-in-law at a distance. That never changed, you know, she didn't seem to become familiar with.
When I was born deaf, my mother cried. She really did not see a future.
The doctor said he would never amount to anything, his mental capacity would be little to none, and you should probably give him up and think about adoption.
Chris probably had one of the worst diagnoses ever. Self-injurious, mental retardation, severe autism. And I was pretty much told to put him in an institution. He ate the walls, he ate the table, he ate the rug. If I coughed, he would run downstairs and punch me.
I think I inherited from my mother, who I used to crawl around the house on all fours. She had two sponges in her hand, and then she had two tied to her knees. She would crawl around behind me going, "Who brings footprints into a building?"
The first ever prescription depressant hit the shelves today. Approved by the FDA last month, Despondex is intended as a treatment for the approximately 20 million Americans who are insufferably cheery.
If you're in a good mood every so often, well, that's fine, that's normal. This is for those that have a persistent positive outlook on life.
Most fiction, however elliptically, is about how humans work, our brains, our emotions, our relationships. By the middle of the 20th century, the whole of literature had been inescapably influenced by the work of Freud and Jung. And in the last few decades, the psychiatrists, psychologists and psychotherapists have themselves taken up their pens to write more than scientific studies, led by the likes of Oliver Sacks. Journalists, too, have learnt from their approach. Andrew Solomon usually writes about art and culture, but he found himself investigating marginal human beings. His ensuing book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children and the Search for Identity, has won him the American National Critics Prize. It did take him 10 years to write, as he told Lindsay Irving.
I originally thought it would be about a four-year project, and the fact that it expanded so much was sometimes rather discouraging, but I felt that in order to make the generalizations I wanted to make authoritatively, I had to become an expert in each of the subtopics, and learning to be expert about the nature of deafness and the criminal justice system and the medical issues around being transgender, those were very different enterprises. The New York Times Magazine asked me to write an article about deaf culture. And I was rather taken aback because I didn't know there was such a thing as deaf culture. I just thought, oh, deafness, what a shame. Those poor people can't hear. What can we do for them? And I went out into the deaf world and I met people who were part of a culture that was united by the use of sign language. I met deaf clubs. I went to look at the Miss Deaf America contest. I got a real sense of the validity of this culture. And I came away thinking it's not my culture and I don't want to join it, but it is a culture. And I thought, how interesting that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, and most of them discover deaf identity only in adolescence. I thought, curiously similar to my experience as a gay person, born to straight parents, who didn't discover gay identity until I was into or past adolescence. So that was when I first began thinking there are these parallels between my experience and some others.
You do identify a basic structure around which all children seem to build their identity, the vertical and horizontal axes.
Vertical identity is the phrase that I've used to describe identities that are passed down from parent to child. So one's ethnicity is a vertical identity. Frequently, one's language is a vertical identity. One's ethnicity. There are many of these things that you have in common with your parents. And your parents tend to give you a sense of pride in those things, even if the world is hard on them. So it might be difficult, as the world is currently constructed, to be South Asian here in London. But if your parents are South Asian and you're South Asian, they teach you to feel good about yourself. But there are these other identities, horizontal identities, which you have to learn from a peer group. So being gay is a horizontal identity. Since most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that's a horizontal identity. Most families of people who are transgender are not themselves transgender. And so there are all of these identities you have to learn from a peer group, and I've called those horizontal identities because you discover them in the world around you rather than having them passed along. And the tendency has been for parents to try to cure or obliterate those identities rather than to reinforce them. And many people who have such identities don't discover them as identities until they get a bit older.
And you experienced this as this yourself, sort of kind of facing your parents across quite a long distance.
Yes. I mean, I had to talk to my parents about the fact that I was gay, and my parents weren't so down with that when it came up. We went through a period of some degree of struggle. I mean, they didn't throw me out of the house and reject me. They just were ill at ease with it. When I started the book, I really thought that what I had experienced was a deficit in love. And what I came to think after working on the book is that there was a deficit in acceptance and that there's a tendency to conflate the two, but that acceptance and love are two different things. And that often parents who seem not to love their child actually love the child very much. They simply can't accept the child. And acceptance always takes a while to achieve.
For some parents, the gulf between them and the exceptional children you discover seems almost unbridgeable. I mean, The most acute example in this book seems to be the severely autistic children, who do seem to many parents like sort of creatures from another planet, or they might as well be.
Many of the parents of autistic children are completely bewildered by having these children. They don't know what to do with them. They're at a loss with them. Autism, of course, covers a very wide spectrum, and there are some people who have milder autism who have an enormous sense of pride in who they are. And then there is the child who has no language and is banging his head against the wall in the corner, who can be heartbreaking. I did find, however, that parents often were able to construct meaning even out of those experiences. It's not that they wanted them, it's not that they would choose them, but given that they had the experience of a child who was so different in this way, they took it as an occasion for learning and for a kind of grace. And I was very struck by how empowering it could be when parents were able to make the shift to trying to look at things in that light. Whether that light was fully accurate or not, if they were trying to construct it, that allowed them to be better parents.
The way they've extended their sympathies always also seems to have enlarged them.
And I found parents said that over and over again. I mean, strikingly, the parents of one child with Down syndrome said to me that while they would cure the Down syndrome in a second for their child, because it was such a hard way to be in the world, they felt that for them it had made them into better people and that they liked being better people. And his mother said, "For David, I would cure it in an instant, but for myself, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything in the world. They've made us who we are, and who we are is so much better than who we would have been otherwise."
You describe very different kinds of children in this book, but it is very startling to find among them in this book criminals whose identities don't seem congenital in quite the same way as the others. The other people seem, as Lady Gaga would say, born this way.
My feeling was that I wanted the first half of the book to deal with actual disease entities, so deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, and multiple severe disabilities, and to really look at how we respond to things we understand as having been sent as medical challenges. And the second half of the book to look at things that are more socially constructed. So prodigies, is it positive difference as difficult as a negative one? When I looked at children conceived in rape, is where your child came from, how your child was conceived, sufficient to give your child that feeling of being alien and foreign that's so uncomfortable? Crime, what happens when you thought your child was just like you and then it turns out your child isn't just like you? What is it a child can do to create, laterally, this sense of alienation and difference within the family? And transgender, really, because it's an area in which thinking has evolved so much and so rapidly, to try to look at what it means for a family to grapple with the embarrassment of having a child make a gender shift and ultimately to come to a sense, as one mother said at the end of it, I loved Paul, but not as much as Kim. When she made the change, she became herself. So I think they all fit in, and I wanted to complicate the conversation with those last four chapters.
Fascinating human stories, but trying to generalize from them, it doesn't get any simpler, does it? It just seems to get more and more complicated.
In a way, it does get simpler, because the ultimate discovery of the book was, okay, each of these experiences is strange and isolating, but all of them have a great deal in common, this dealing with a child who's different or alien or foreign or upsetting, whatever it is that one wants to characterize the child as. If all of these parents who feel so alone dealing with having a deaf child, and all of the parents who are struggling with having a child with schizophrenia, and all of the parents struggling with having a child who was conceived in rape, understand how much they have in common, then they're no longer in these little minorities, and they're actually part of the majority of humanity. And I also felt that while I was looking at very extreme differences, that the experience of struggling with your child being different is the universal experience of parenthood. I have yet to meet any parent who hasn't occasionally looked at his child and thought, where did you come from? Exactly.
Children of rape victims do present, again, an enormous imaginative challenge for the parents.
But I was also amazed by how people had managed to rise above their experience. So there was one woman, was a Latino woman who was raped in New York City when she was 15 and became pregnant, came from a Catholic family, didn't consider terminating the pregnancy, had this child, and it had really a terrible time dealing with having a child much too young and a shift in their family dynamics and so on. And when I met her some 30 years after the event had taken place, I said to her, "Do you often think about the man who raped you? Do you have a sense of who he is?" And she said, "You know, I used to think of him frequently," she said, "and with anger. But now I think of him with pity." "Pity?" I said. And she said, "Yes," she said, "because he has a beautiful daughter and three beautiful grandchildren. And he doesn't know that. And I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one." And I thought that ability to reconstruct her own experience was so powerful and represented a kind of heroism and had allowed her to be a good mother and grandmother. And when I was in Rwanda, while I was working on that chapter as well, I interviewed a number of women who had children conceived in rape in the genocide. And one of them, we did a long interview, and at the end of it, I said, "Do you have any questions for me?" And she looked at me and she said, "Can you tell me how to love my daughter more? Because I want to love her so much, but when I look at her, I see what happened to me. Can you tell me how to love my daughter more?"
Historically, societies and individuals have always sought to shelter among people who are like them or seem like them. The heroes of this book are the people who have imaginatively and lovingly extended themselves beyond people who are like them. It begins to look like a revolutionary program.
You know, I didn't set out to write the book feeling like a social radical, but I ended up feeling like a social radical. I think that we have to have an inclusive society, one which accepts and tolerates difference at every possible level, one that examines the experience of difference in the most open possible way. And that's turned out to be a very radical message, and it's made some people very angry. But I feel we have to give people who are dealing with deafness, either the children or their parents, the option to use cochlear implants, but we also have to accept the possibility that some of them won't want to. And we can't come in with some idea of normal and ask that everyone conform to it and exclude the people who don't. That seems like an obvious principle, but it turns out it's quite a contentious one. I have a kind of counterphobic tendency, and I think part of the reason that I did this book is that I had to rush into categories that frightened me. I have to be honest, when I went to my first WARF conference, I thought, this is totally weird. All of these people are 3 feet tall. It made me very edgy and uncomfortable. When I first began dealing with transgender people, I thought, it's so strange that anyone would actually have that kind of cutting up of themselves in order to approximate some other gender. But having spent a long time now working in this area, I stopped being so afraid of everyone. And if there's anything I hope for from this book, it's that it will help other people not to be so afraid of differences, not to be so afraid of these particular differences, not to be afraid of difference altogether.
Andrew Solomon. Far From the Tree, Parents, Children and the Search for Identity is published by Chatto & Windus. As Andrew said, he tried to become as expert as a psychiatrist in understanding his outsiders. One of writer Saul Bellow's sons did actually become a psychotherapist. On his retirement, Greg Bellow sat down to write the story of his relationship with his father, which continued after Saul walked out on Greg's mother. He called it, rather dramatically, Saul Bellow's Heart, a son's memoir.
I was eight when he left. I'd like to describe my life before my parents split up as a sort of kaleidoscopic. Before I was born, my parents lived what I would call a very gypsy existence. In fact, my mother once counted up the number of places that she had lived during the course of her 15-year marriage to Saul, and she had 22 addresses. And about halfway through their marriage in 1944, I was born. And they didn't really miss a beat. We were on the move all the time. And I lived in France, I lived in Italy, I lived in Minneapolis, I lived in Upper New York State. I lived in a palace in Austria, the Schloss Leopoldskron, for a month. And all that happened before I was six. When I was six, my parents moved back to the United States. My father was fairly well along in having written Augie March. And we moved into a neighborhood in Queens, New York. And by the time I was eight, I think he had had enough of suburban or life or urban life or married life or family life, and he moved out.
I was particularly taken with your descriptions of Paris, this bohemian Paris, absolutely full of all the writers that we all want to read now, all these years on. So, for example, James Baldwin, who came round to your flat to borrow the shower.
And also, my father used to say rather sarcastically, he showed up just before dinner time. I was 5 years old, and I really have no memory of them. This is only stories that my parents told me later.
You describe your father as your best friend, as having been your best friend at the age
right.
of six. And yet he left you. And you're now a psychotherapist. How do you look back on the little boy that you were then and what happened to you?
I look back on my childhood as one of happiness before he left and sadness after his departure. He understood me better than my mother, I think, in many ways. He certainly understood my feelings better than my mother. And he understood very much how bereft I was at his departure. I mean, not only was I a psychotherapist, I was a psychotherapist who specialized in work with children. You know, my father said to me once, you know, that you turn the misery of your childhood into your career. And he was quite right. I had great sympathy for little boys who were troubled and pained, and I had a talent for it.
But there's a delicacy, particularly around your trying to work out what was going on for your mother. Now, they had an open marriage, famously, but you said she likely hoped to hurt Saul with her infidelities. But you don't claim that knowledge in her.
If they had an open marriage, I don't know if there was a verbal contract. I think they subscribed to Trotskyite, a version of Trotskyite sexual liberation. But my father was a much more active participant or advocate or whatever than my mother. What I'm saying about it is that I think that she did it mostly out of being hurt by my father because his infidelities outnumbered her by, you know, hundreds or dozens, or I don't really know. And I think she was trying to get his attention and to let him know what he was doing to her.
How did his life go into his fiction? I mean, one of the things you rather touchingly say you did as in honor of him was to reread all his work. That was one of your tributes to him.
The motive power from his fiction came from the fact that he was really writing about himself and his own life and his own feelings. And when I thought about his life in a different way after he passed away, I began to see moments when he was very, very candid on the page. More candid, I think, than he was in his personal relationships or in real life. So that it gives me a window into his frame of mind as he was going through midlife crises, you know, the blow up with his second wife, the infidelity in particular. I mean, that's very, very clearly shown up in Herzog. But there are little moments when he sort of says things, almost asides, where I say, you know, I think that's the way my father felt. That's the way Pop felt. You know, that's a unique reading, which I'm privileged to be able to make and to try to communicate. And I felt it was important to do that as part of the book because the books were so much a part of him and he was so much a part of the books.
And you did have a sense of being shut out by his literary side, didn't you, as a child?
It was literal. You know, every morning my father would get up, have breakfast, and go either somewhere else or into another room, mostly into another room, turn the hi-fi up so loud that, you know, he blotted out everything else, and play Mozart or Beethoven or Bach for somewhere between 4 and 6 hours, and you were just not supposed to go in. That was the rule. Pop was writing. Now, when I was 2 or 3, I did, but I certainly learned quickly enough that was his time and his space, and I interrupted him rarely, if ever, when he was writing. So then it was sort of literal. When I became an adult, I felt that a lot of the things that went along with all the late life fame, I was turned off by much of it. I was turned off by people fawning over him and not being honest with him and ingratiating themselves and trying to curry favor with him. Our relationship was never about literature. I mean, it was a father-son relationship. And that's what I focused on. I focused on the life. And then when he passed away, I realized that almost everybody else was focusing on the books.
You talk about the young Saul, the idealistic young Saul, becoming the bitter old Saul, who was defined by anger, intolerance, and preoccupations with evil and with his death.
Gloria Cronin, who's the editor of the Saul Bellow Journal and with whom I've become somewhat friendly and have had some very long conversations about him, felt that he had a spiritual crisis during the 1960s, late 60s and early 70s. During the years I was in college, which were the mid-60s and then into the early 70s, you know, American society was turned, you know, upside down, inside out. There was the war. There was the civil rights struggle. Oh, there was also the Six-Day War in Israel. And all of those had a profound events, had a profound, profound effect on my father and made him feel as if, at least my understanding of it, is that basically the anarchy of the 60s just frightened him immensely. He felt that the chaos and the threat of the breakdown of society was an outgrowth of his radicalism and the idealism of the 30s, the 20s and the 30s in the Russian Revolution, and that he felt that he had made a terrible, terrible mistake in participating in it and thinking about it and being so committed to it. And he did a 180, particularly about cultural conservatism. The pressure for recognition and academic advancement and political power on the part of women, on the part of blacks, organized groups and people who were pushing for social change turned him off very much, and he really went after those groups and those people in public and private, and I thought they had a case. They had been shut out, and I felt they, you know, warranted some consideration, and he was having none of it.
Did you ever fall out with him over it, or were you, he never ostracized you because of your views?
The love between us always won out, but we had a lot of bitter arguments.
You're a psychoanalytically trained psychotherapist, which is a form of storytelling, isn't it? How do you think that your form of storytelling relates to your father's as a novelist?
He thought that there was an immense amount contained in the wisdom of individual experience, and as a psychotherapist, I would definitely concur with that. In other words, people have a subjective truth, which is very important. And I certainly feel as if, although I'm retired, as if I spent a great deal of my time helping people to find and be comfortable with the subjective truth inside of themselves. And he, I think, felt that individual narrative and individual stories of life, individual accounts of life, also carried a great deal of meaning. And in that way, I think we were soulmates.
Just one final question. Do you think you were lucky or unlucky to have him as a father?
Oh, lucky, lucky, lucky. You know, he enriched my life in a way, you know, that is very unique. I mean, I had to make sense of it when I talked about the kaleidoscopic childhood. I mean, I had to make adult sense of it. And one of the ways in which I made adult sense of it was to go around for the 10 or 15 years before I wrote the book and talked to all these people from my childhood and get the adult perspective on what they saw and what they saw about me and what they saw about Saul. But I lived in an enriched environment as a child, very enriched environment, and a great deal of it rubbed off on me.
Were you able to make a family of your own that didn't end up with everybody going off in different directions?
Yes.
So you have a family life that wasn't in a classic textbook way, you could say your family that you're born into is dysfunctional.
It was very unusual to have a divorce in your family when my parents divorced. You know, 20 years later, it wasn't unusual at all. But I was very ashamed of it. I never told anybody that my parents were divorced. I had a mistrust of relationships with women when I was young. I never thought I would ever marry. I mean, my motto was my father, and women came and women went. You know, and by the time I was old enough to consider dating seriously, he was on his third marriage. But you know, I worked it out in my own analysis and my own therapy, and I married a lovely woman who was a classmate of mine. We've been married for 42 years plus. We have two lovely children. We have four grandchildren. That's certainly nothing like the life I saw when I was a child, or the life I lived when I was a child, and the life I saw my father live. You know, he was peripatetic. He was always on the move, and I was not.
The remarkably well-adjusted Greg Bellow. Saul Bellow's Heart is published by Bloomsbury. For all his personal insight into his father's life, Greg stopped short of thinking he could treat him.
On closure. My records show that I saw Alice P. for consultation in June 1988. She began our meeting by telling me, "I haven't felt myself for years. I don't know how to pull myself out of it." She told me a little about her family. She and her husband wanted to give their two daughters a good start, and the girls had done well. This year, their younger daughter would get her degree in medicine from Oxford. Towards the end of the consultation, Alice sat forward in her chair. She told me that 19 years earlier, their third child, Jack, had died unexpectedly. He was 3 months old. It was a Friday, the 27th of June, 1969, just after lunch. I fed Jack, put him down for his nap. When I came back, he was dead. I listened as Alice then described a passage from C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, in which Lewis fears that bit by bit he is losing the memory of his dead wife. Like snowflakes settling down on her memory of her until her real shape is hidden, is how Lewis puts it. "It's not like that for me," Alice said. "I remember everything about Jack. The smell of his skin, his smile, everything." Keeping absolutely still, she said, "A couple of days ago, I was in the kitchen making breakfast, listening to the radio, and there was that dreadful news story about those kids that got killed in the boating accident. I thought, Jack's safe from drowning. I think like that. Jack's safe from drunk drivers. Jack won't ever get cancer or have a heart attack. My baby's safe. That's crazy. I shouldn't be thinking like that."
Our final author, Stephen Gross, is also an analyst, born in Indiana in the US, but trained and practicing in London.
6 months ago, Edmund Kay asked to see me for a consultation. At 29, Edmund was already the director of an international humanitarian aid organisation. During the previous 5 years, he had visited over 30 countries, supervising relief work in Afghanistan, Sudan, and Iraq. He had been on antidepressants since the age of 19 when his father committed suicide. "I shouldn't have to be on antidepressants," he said to me. "But every time I start to come off them, I find myself back where I was when I was 19, angry with my dad for killing himself. It's so stupid. I should have had closure on this thing years ago." Alice P. and Edmund Kay are grieving, each in their own way. What they have in common is this. They suffer more because they're stuck on the idea of closure. They suffer more because they both expect to make progress, to move through certain stages of grief. And when they don't, they feel that they're doing something wrong, or, more precisely, that there is something wrong with them. They suffer twice, first from grief, and then from a tyranny of shoulds.
His approach, he says, is to help his patients cope better with the real world. His book, The Examined Life, is a kindly collection of stories gathered from his consulting room. And he's here with me now, on my podcasting couch, for examination. I'm very interested in the ethics of writing stories up from your clinical practice.
It's very important to me. The question's about confidentiality. People come not to be turned into stories, but because they're in pain and because they want their problem solved. As long as there's been psychoanalysis, and as long as there's been, well, in the human sciences, psychology or medicine, we've had to discuss cases. So from the first, there's been ways of anonymizing cases and changing. In my stories, I will change absolutely everything to preserve the truth of the psychological moment that I'm trying to represent. And the other thing is that in many of the cases, I ask the patient for their permission. I showed them the draft and they read it.
And where I'm leading to, partly with this question, is this idea of truth, which is a word that novelists use a lot to as distinct from fact.
Yes.
And I'm interested in how, if you've changed everything,
yes,
how can it be truth still?
Well, what you're trying to do, what I was trying to do, what makes my book perhaps a bit different is my pieces are very short. They're 1,000, 2,000 words. They're not long case histories, so I'm not giving all the backstory or all that happens afterwards. What I'm most interested in is the moment, and often the moment of change. It's what, in short stories, William Trevor called the art of the glimpse, when he's talking about Chekhov, trying to focus down on a very particular moment.
Your subtitle is How We Lose and Find Ourselves.
Yes.
Do you feel that it's a cheerful trajectory?
My readers do, I do, and it's not to say that there isn't pain in it. Well, it's like life. There will be happiness in it and there will be unhappiness in it. I think there's more happiness and more a feeling of peace in ourselves if we do accept our lives and do accept the things that are happening to us. How we lose ourselves is sometimes trying to hide things like loss from ourselves, that we things that are happening in our lives that we don't wish to see.
There's an awful lot of grief in this book, isn't there? A grief of loss of people who've died, for a start.
I think there is. I mean, because that can be sometimes what people are struggling with, to accept that. But there's also stories about people changing and getting on and having children and having babies in places where they hadn't been able to. So I hope there's birth in it too.
Tell us a little bit about some of the individual stories. I was very interested in the case, for example, of the man who faked his suicide.
Right. What I wanted to capture, that's the first story in the book, was I was trying to capture how sometimes patients don't have words. I think it's true to all of us that there are sometimes moments where we can't put into words certain things from our lives, perhaps because we grew up in a family or in a place where the very thing that was bothering us, the very thing in the family that was the disturbance, was not talked about. So people didn't give the child the words for it. And as adults, we found other ways of coping. And one of the ways we can cope is sometimes by making other people feel certain things or feeling certain things ourselves. So that story was a story about someone who couldn't communicate the disturbance and upset that they had felt, but did that by making their therapist feel it. They couldn't put it into words. And the idea of that story is to try and disentangle that.
And that is a very humbling experience, presumably, for you as a therapist, in that he tricked you for years.
I guess what I want to say is there's no reason why someone should tell me the truth, too. There's no way. I have to earn someone's truth, and sometimes I have to earn their trust. That can take time. It would be odd if someone came in right away and told you their true story or trusted you. You have to earn that, and that takes a while. As we do outside, as myself as a parent or in my personal life, I will get at an impasse with people. And we all do. We all make mistakes. We all get at impasses. But that can be the beginning of disentangling and getting to a solution. So what I wanted to show, and that's how therapy often works, as it works, like I would have thought in your job or most jobs, where we don't get something at first and then we work it out. And I wanted to get that on the page because the book is not just trying to tell stories. It was trying to show a kind of way of thinking, or disposition towards my patients, but also towards life.
There are a few moments when it almost tips into self-help. So, for example, the story about your daughter and what praise does to children.
There's some pieces which are more essay than story. That's one of them. But that seemed to me a sort of important point to make. It was also a point to myself. And although I start with her, it's really about indifference and how we show our indifference. And I was trying to make the point in that piece that in the past people showed their indifference by being thoughtlessly critical of their children, just sort of endlessly and thoughtlessly critical. And nowadays it seemed to me that sometimes we were giving empty praise the way that a previous generation had given thoughtless criticism, but both expressed a kind of indifference and an inability to really be present with a child.
I have to say, as a mother, even hearing you talk about it now, I'm shivering. There's a sort of shiver. I recognise myself in that, the moments when one doesn't attend to one's children.
Yeah, I mean, I recognise myself in it too, and I write these things also for myself.
I want to come to the literary quality of this work, because it is very literary. One of the ways in which it's literary is the way that you've structured it. They are grouped, and so you go from beginnings to telling lies to loving to changing to leaving. You've created a narrative arc.
Yeah, the arc is from birth to death. I mean, there is a kind of arc of childhood to leaving. I thought about that very much. It is 31 stories that could be read in any order. You could pick one out like a short story, and they're written like short stories. But I wanted them, when put together, to have that arc, to give that sort of picture of a disposition, so that you could see a way of thinking about a whole range of problems. And the 31 pieces, too, I narrowed it down to these because I thought these were about the most critical issues and problems that people face and think about. Certainly my friends, my wife and I, the things I see in our children, these are the things we talk about. And I wanted to put those critical issues in the book.
But in the structuring of it and the creation of this narrative arc, mm-hmm. you are in a way making yourself into an omniscient narrator, aren't you?
I do certain things, like I reveal more about myself towards the end of the book. It does come from literature. When I read a novel, I only believe the novel if I believe the narrator. The narrator is so important, so getting that voice right and how much to disclose and trying to judge that was important.
You also play with tenses, really interestingly. Yeah. I was wondering how aware you were of that, that you change from the present to the past.
I'm very aware of that. And how I placed each story next to each other was also very thought about. Also the way they're written, like some where you said it's more self-help, like that piece ends with a sort of moral at the end. Some of them have a bit of a, like Aesop's fable quality, where at the end, or La Fontaine, there's a kind of moral. Robert Bly said they're poems that are like tunnels that are open at the beginning and open at the end, and there's some that snap shut at the end. And I tried to have both. I tried to also vary them so that the stories, some of them are open at the end, just like some sessions and some therapies are. We don't know quite where things are going to go.
You're an analyst of 25 years standing with 50,000 hours of patient face time, you say in the book. What made you suddenly to decide to take this very different track of writing it down in a book?
I'd always wanted to be a writer. I've always read. I've read a lot, and I read a lot of fiction, a lot of short stories. There are personal reasons why I wanted to do the book, and not so personal reasons. The personal reasons are, you're right, I'm 60 years old. This is my first book. I married at 50. I have a daughter, 10, and a son, 7. My mother died at 64. By the time he was my age, my father had had 2 heart attacks. And I didn't know if I would be there to talk to my children about these things. So the book is, as I said, it's the issues that I thought were the most important. And I wanted to say to my children, these are the things that I've learned and I wanted you to know. But I also, as I said, I wanted to give them a picture about a different way of thinking. And other people, this is the less personal, I wanted people to have a way of thinking so they might not feel so trapped with their problems.
Do you feel that it's part of a community of writing?
Psychoanalysis is deeply linked to storytelling. It always has been. And what I've always loved were the case histories and the stories. Another reason how I came to write the book was my wife translated Freud's Studies in Hysteria, one of his first books, and we spent a summer going through her translation and reading the case histories very closely, line by line. And what really impressed me was they were short stories, he calls them novellas, and that the truth could be told very powerfully, this offstage experience of being with a patient, perhaps best in a story. not in this theoretical discussion or a technical paper, that there was something else that helped us to really believe a story to be true. And that was if the analyst could give the sense of being there with the patient. It didn't matter the length. You can read case histories that are hundreds of pages. Sometimes it's just a little snippet of material presented by an analyst. By the way, this isn't just analysis too. I think anthropologists, a whole range of people have to do this, where they have an offstage experience and have to get it down on the paper. And I see my book as in the context of that tradition of psychoanalysis.
Freud has been criticized in the past of allowing his storytelling to run away with him, hasn't he?
But we're not alone in that. I mean, anthropologists have that too. You know, people have said that about, you know, Levi-Strauss or Margaret Mead. Anyone in the human sciences will have that dilemma of writing about something, and then how are you going to judge it? I think what I've tried to do in my book is counteract that by focusing on something very small that hopefully the reader will identify with, and in a sense, learning from literature to pare down to the moment and not, you know, going large, but actually trying to stay small.
Are there other writers in your area that you admire who we would be generally aware of?
I have to say the people that I learn from are short story writers. They are Carver, they are Cheever, Nabokov. Kafka was a great, more recently, Tobias Wolff, George Saunders. There's also a kind of tendency of like the trends now in nonfiction writing, Andrew Solomon's work, you know, we were thinking about. I think a lot of people are working at this from different angles, how to give people these narratives that they would not know about otherwise.
Stephen Gross's The Examined Life is published by Chatto & Windus. And that's all from us this week. If you'd like further details of any of the books we've discussed, you can find them on the podcast page on the Guardian Books site. Do let us know if you have any other books you think we should know about in this fascinating area. If you've come to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, just search for Guardian Books Podcast or click on the link marked podcast on the front page of guardian.co.uk/books. There you'll find links to help you subscribe. It's free and you'll never miss another edition. Thanks for now to Stephen Gross, Greg Bellow, Andrew Solomon and Lindsay Irving, not to mention our reader Susie Grimshaw. I'm Claire Armistead and my producer is Tim Mabey. From us both, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardian audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.